You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Good evening, Richard.
Over there in Not Watford, and we're joined once again by Francois Thomazeau. Hello, Francois.
Hi there.
Well, fellas, just the one Grand Tour on at the moment. It's a bit boring, isn't it? The brave new era of the Grenadiers that Dave Brailsford talked about on Sunday. They were going to just be an attacking team, not riding defensively at all. Well, that lasted 48 hours, didn't it? pretty much as you were, as they rode today in defence of the red jersey held by Richard Carapaz. Cracking stage, the Vuelta, really, really kind of mouth-watering in terms of setting up the next couple of weeks, because you just feel that anything could still happen. Did you enjoy it from your Marseille bolt hole there, Francois?
Oh yeah, I did, really, because I mean, first of all, it was nice, you know, this past couple of weeks to watch three or four races at the same time, but it's kind of nice to concentrate a little bit, and it was, you know, action packed enough to be interesting, and also the guys we had at the front today, maybe not the leading contenders to win the Vuelta. You see, I mix it up to win the Vuelta because I mean we thought, you know, in the first couple of stages that the GC was decided, but I mean, you know, when you look at the names in the break and the names in the chasing group, I mean, it was really, really great racing today, like a small Spanish club. Classic in a way, and to see Valverde, one of the commentators here said riding like a junior, because that's what he did, and that's also why he lost, and to see Mike Woods come back and win this a little bit like Dan Martin earlier in the race, they had their injury problems and they deserved this, so yeah, it was thrilling, it was exciting, it was moving at times, and I loved it.
It's all topsy-turvy. Jumbo Visma riding like Movistar and Movistar riding like Jumbo Visma. In this episode we're going to talk mainly about the Vuelta, but we're still a few odds and ends from the Giro to wrap up, including Ciro Scogna Emilio's take on Tao Geoghegan-Hart's victory. We'll hear from Ciro. We will hear from Mike Woods, who we spoke to just after the stage. He was in the car going back to the hotel, so we caught up with him. We'll hear a bit from Harry Tanfield as well. We'll there are a few little outstanding bits and pieces from the Giro that we'll cover in part two. But Lionel, do you have the headlines for us, please?
Well, it's kind of a tale of the tapas. Oh, no, what is it?
Oh, yeah, tale, of course. We're back to that,
tale,
aren't
of,
we?
Tale of the etapa. Tale of the
tapas. Yeah, well, tale of the tapas.
Tale of
just
the tapas.
A day in the life of Lionel, isn't it?
I'll try to not masticate whilst delivering the headlines from today's stage. It was a classic little tour of the Basque Country stage again, wasn't it? Really, 159 kilometres, stage 7, the first one after the rest day, with two climbs of the Puerto de Oduna climb, which, set the scene for quite an exciting finish between five riders. But there was a huge break that got away, 38 riders in all, including some danger men for the GC, really. Alejandro Valverde, Mikel Nieve and George Bennett have hauled themselves a little bit up the general classification. The gains they made might not have been as big as they could have been, but still, it does put George Bennett of Jumbo-Visma back in touch. He's now in 10th place, and Valverde, as you say, I mean, certainly the grey jersey as best veteran rider, I think. Well, Dan Martin, I suppose, as well, but Alejandro Valverde, I mean, is now talking about extending his career. I think he was going to call it a day at the end of this year, wasn't he? But he's going to do another one, I gather. Is that right? Do you know that?
I think he was always going to do next
was
year
he?
As well.
Right.
But yeah, he's kind of gone back and forth a little bit on it.
Well, anyway, it was impressive to see Valverde up the road when this break started to fracture. Obviously, 38 riders, far too many to sort of contest the finish. And so when it was Godon of AG2R, De Wolf of Lotto Soudal, and Valverde, who were the three men up the road, at one point being chased by Bennett, Magnus Cort, and Tim Wellens. But then it all sort of came back together again as they approached the final climb. And with 22 kilometres to go, Mike Woods gave us a taste of what was to come. He attacked and kind of teased out the best climbers in that group. George Bennett, Alejandro Valverde, Sepp Kuss were the ones that were first reacting. And Nans Peters, the stage winner in the Pyrenees at the Tour de France, of course, he was in the final split along with Guillaume Martin of Cofidis and Omer Frehley. So it was that five-man group that went over the top of the climb. Well, Woods was just off the front, wasn't he? And the other four were chasing Frehley, Valverde, Martin and Peters. And then we had a real humdinger of a finish on the flat, rolling downhill. There was a bit of everything on that run in, and everyone had a go at the bit of terrain that seemed to suit them best. I thought Peters had a go when it was rising, Martin had a go when it was climbing, but he looked to me to be the rider with the least amount of grunt for going for a long one. So 7 kilometers from the finish looked a bit ambitious for him. Then Valverde had a dig, and there was a slight bit of hesitation, but it again all came back together, and Frehley and Woods went. And then the final move, with a kilometre to go, just outside the kilometre to go mark, Mike Woods got clear and held on. A really impressive finish. Mike Woods loves this part of Spain because his only other Grand Tour stage win was in the Vuelta, not that, all that far away, just a little bit northwest of where they finished today in Villanueva de Valdegovia. An impressive stage win for Mike Woods and EF Pro Cycling. And overall, Richard Carapaz is still in the red jersey, 18 seconds ahead of Hugh Carthy. Ineos Grenadiers did have to do a lot of that defensive work, didn't they, though? Riding on the front, making sure that the break didn't go much beyond 2.5 minutes on what was pretty challenging terrain to chase on for, well, quite a lot of the afternoon. And as I say, Valverde, Bennett and Nieve have just moved themselves a little bit up the overall.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thank you to iWaka for supporting the Cycling Podcast. They've been with us since the spring, and they've seen us all the way through our Giro and the Tour de France and now the Grandest Tour. And it's no exaggeration to say that we wouldn't have been able to do all of that without their support. Over the next few episodes, we're going to be hearing from a few of the members of the iWaka team who recently did a charity bike ride to raise money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust. Now, more about the ride in future episodes, but first, let's meet the driving force behind organising that ride.
My name's Liv Denyer. I'm a product manager working on iWalker's new product, iWalker Pay. So we're aiming to help businesses offer payment terms to their customer without needing to take on credit risk. So we started building iWalker Pay at the beginning of this year, and the general aim was to try and help fix the payments space within B2B transactions. And then the COVID-19 crisis hit, and it particularly hit small and medium businesses really, really hard. And we found that, you know, in the B2B space, many businesses deliver goods or services before they're paid for them. And then in the pandemic, suddenly they weren't being paid for things that they'd already done, and they weren't sure when their customers were going to be able to pay for them. We surveyed some small business owners during the pandemic and found something like 40% of them had more than £10,000 of outstanding invoices, and many weren't sure when they were going to get paid. And that's the problem that we're really trying to solve. We were just lucky that we ended up building a product that became so much more necessary than we ever expected this year.
If you want to find out more about iWalker Pay and how it could help your small or medium-sized business, go to iwalker.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk. We'll hear more from Liv tomorrow.
Well, as I said earlier, it was a really entertaining stage. You know, not super tough, but a lot of teams had a go. And it struck me watching it that this could be a race where it's a real benefit to have more than one card to play. I mean, Ineos Grenadiers did spend a lot of the day chasing and defending. And in the end, Andre Amador did an awful lot. You know, he was left as Carapaz's last remaining teammate for, you know, about 20 kilometers, and he did really well to hold the gap, because at one point Valverde was almost the virtual red jersey, wasn't he? But I just think if every day is like that, and there are teams like Jumbo-Visma, like Movistar, who have, you know, several different options now. You know, Jumbo-Visma did move George Bennett back up, Sepp Kuss as well, is not completely out of it, I wouldn't say. It could be a sort of race where having just one, you know, leader, as Ineos do with Carapaz, that might be quite a risky strategy in this race.
Well, it's been a risky strategy in Grand Tours this season, obviously, because the guys who were expecting to shine were not the guys who finally made it. Well, think of the Giro or you know, other Grand Tours. And in the same, yeah, in the same kind of ideas, I'm amazed, and I think that's a short season revealed that by the density and the depth of the World Tour peloton. Actually, yeah, I could name about 30 or 40 riders of you know, of great level. I mean, today the guys were in the front, whether it's, you know, Bennett, Martin, well, Valverde, of course, but you know, Mike Woods. I mean, all these guys, and in the Giro we had those guys every day. They were about, it's like, you know, in tennis sometimes you have top 50 guys who are all excellent players and could win tournaments, and that's the case in the World Tour now. Yeah, it's not like you had 10 or, you know, 5 or 10 guys really crushing the rest of the opposition and then the other being just domestic. My impression is that the team play in World Tour cycling, maybe it's because the season was so short and was so unusual, but team play has changed quite a bit, and we have more actors, more guys who can play a really interesting part in a stage these days compared to some of the boring Grand Tours of the past with, you know, trains leading the way and domestics doing their jobs and picking the bottles. You get more and more guys who seem in you know, in a position to win stages or be contenders, so that's great.
Richard, does that mean that Movistar are in the driving seat then, with Enric Mas in fifth place, a minute and seven down, Marc Soler in seventh place, a minute and 42 down, and now Valverde in ninth place, 2 minutes and three down? I mean,
well, they look reborn, don't they, Movistar? I mean, they've began this race in a very dynamic way, and all those guys have been up there on different days. So maybe it's the Trident, it's the new Trident at Movistar, and it's working. But, you know, they are riding very aggressively, and I thought Valverde looked great today. So it's yeah, I mean, Movistar have the bit between their teeth, and they do have several different cards to play, and that could be a huge advantage in this race, because it does look chaotic and frenetic. And like I say, Carapaz, as we heard from Daniel a couple of nights ago, Carapaz is obviously a man in form and a man on a mission. But, you know, if every day is going to be like today, it's going to be quite tough for him and his team, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, you say a Trident. Well, we'll see over the coming days a Trident or a sort of bent fork. You know, they sometimes resemble that more, don't they, Movistar? But
which prong will go first? Yeah,
indeed. But what you say, I mean, it's today was not a stage that really should have necessarily taxed Ineos Grenadiers too much in their defence of the red jersey, you know, on paper, especially when you consider that, well, tomorrow there's a proper uphill finish where they'll need to make sure that Carapaz gets into the bottom of that in good position. And then, of course, over the weekend, two consecutive uphill finishes, including the one to the Angliru, all being well. So being forced to do all of that work on a day when they perhaps might have thought they wouldn't have to chase too hard or work too hard or, as you say, burn down to Amador quite early. You know, those days are the ones that take their toll and might leave them vulnerable to multiple attacks from others a bit later on.
I think also, Lionel, that those conventional mountain stages are almost easier for Carapaz. There's a sort of natural sorting out there. And we spoke to George Bennett last week, who said that, you know, the GC would almost be done and dusted by the time trial at the weekend. But actually, that final week, it's all stages like today. It's kind of rolling up and down, hard to control if you're being attacked left, right and centre. And, you know, it's not just sort of Movistar versus Jumbo-Visma versus Ineos. There's lots of other teams as well. Sunweb are up there every day. Other teams as well are having a real go. So, yeah, I mean, it could be quite a tricky final week, even though on paper it looks, you know, not too difficult.
To be honest, I'm not yet very worried about Carapaz and Ineos, because I mean, Carapaz since the start of the season, or since the tour at least, has been very consistent and never really faltered tragically. And today, okay, it was, you know, there were attacks from all over the place, and it was exciting, and they were but they never really looked in serious trouble. And the guys were up front, Valverde, Bennett are GC contenders in a way, but were not directly threatening the red jersey whatsoever. Valverde, the way he rode was absolutely stupid in many ways. I mean, he wasted lots of energy. He attacked from 70k from the line. I mean, this guy is, you know, he's one of the most experienced World Tour riders. He's the most experienced World Tour rider now, and he really raced like a junior. I mean, he attacked. He launched kind of lame attacks about a dozen times, and he had nothing left in him in the finale. I don't really know what he gained from today, actually, and I'm not sure Movistar gained anything from today's stage. So I don't know. I found the Ineos Grenadiers pretty solid. I mean, their morale can only be boosted by their incredible showing in the Vuelta, in the Giro, I mean.
It's an easy mistake to make.
That's two, Francois.
Yeah, that's two. I'm sorry about that. Exactly, three of them out. But and I'm sure that the moral boost from the Giro is not just words. I mean, they you know, the karma in the team, very astonishingly, when you think that, you know, at the beginning of the season, you know, Froome, Bernal and Thomas were their nominated leaders. I think the spirit is higher than it's ever been. And we, again, at the beginning of the stage, so Chris Froome, acting at the as the perfect team captain in a way, and he's improving that in that role as well.
I mean, in the end, you're right, Francois. You ask what the Movistar game. Well, they lead the team classification. Let's not forget.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I mean, I think it's more the way they look and the way they've been riding with real purpose. Mm-hmm. And Valverde rode with real purpose today. But as you say, he did seem to ride quite... I mean, he wasn't the sort of wily old fox that he's been on so many occasions, where he's sort of relied on that finish that he's got. He seemed to want, or seemed to think he needed to win alone today, which is unusual, but I guess that's because maybe his speed is dimming a little bit. And the guy who outfoxed them all was Mike Woods. I thought I would try calling Mike Woods after the finish. I didn't think he'd maybe be in a position to answer the call, but he was. So here he is after the finish.
Hey, Richard.
Hey, Mike. I thought I'd just try you on the off chance for the podcast. How are you doing? Congratulations.
I'm doing well. Thanks, man.
Where have I caught you?
I'm just in the middle of, I'm in the car right now driving back to the hotel.
Well, you must be feeling pretty happy.
Yeah, I'm pretty stoked, pretty happy about today.
And you love the Basque Country.
Man, riding here is great. I always race well here. It's just good energy, I guess. I don't know. Unfortunately, there weren't as many fans out, but yeah, it was special.
And, I mean, it didn't look like a stage that really would have necessarily suited you on paper. You know, are you sort of diversifying your talents a bit, because we see you excelling on really steep climbs? Today was quite a different finish.
Yeah, the initial plan for me was not actually to not even go into the breakaway. I was supposed to stay around Hugh, but then the break got so big on that climb that I decided it'd be best to get one more guy in there just in case he was to come across or something happened, just have guys up front. And then, yeah, so I just got in there, and then all of a sudden I thought, okay, well, maybe I got a shot at winning today.
Well, you went away on your own for a bit and then you were caught. And what did Valverde say to you? I heard you say that you sat on because obviously you're defending Carthy's position as well. But what did he say to you in that group?
Yeah, Valverde is always, he's actually always a gentleman in the races. And like, he like immediately accepted it. Like he was, like I said, sorry, like desculpe, you know, I have Hugh Carthy in the GC and we can't let you get away. So he accepted it and rode like he always does, just still like a champion. So
I think he'll be out for revenge in the next few days because I think he wanted to win the stage, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I mean, a rider of his caliber, I don't think that's going to be too hard for him.
I mean, just a brief word on the race, Mike. It's been a crazy first week. Does it feel like that being in the race itself, that it seems very unpredictable, very open, anything can happen?
Yeah, this has been probably the least predictable Grand Tour I've been in. Certainly the hardest style. Guys are racing like it could be their last day. And certainly with COVID, that kind of specter is hanging over the race. However, after the recent announcements, plus all the tests coming back negative, I think we've got a real shot at making it now to Madrid. But I don't think that's going to calm anybody down.
And now the priority, another stage win or helping Hugh defend his position? He looks like he's in great form.
Yeah, he's doing great. Obviously, the number, like now, especially that I've got the win, it's going to be focusing on his GC, but hopefully I'll get one or two more chances.
Who knows, eh? Well, I'll let you get on. Thanks very much for answering the call, Mike.
No problem, Richard.
Good luck. Thanks a lot.
So that was Mike Woods, his second stage win at the Vuelta in the Basque Country. And one or two comments about the fact that after he'd been away on his own and he was caught by that little group, he refused to go through. He explained afterwards it was because he was protecting Hugh Carthy's overall position. But what did you make of that? I mean, sometimes in that situation a rider won't work, and that's fair enough, but then they won't contest the finish. He obviously did, and he won a fantastic victory. But was that the right thing to do? Is it all fair in love and war?
Well, you know, coming back to the Giro, I got it right this time. I said at the time last week that I thought Jan Inley should have attacked, and my impression is that team tactics, as I said before, are changing a little bit in this new context. And well, fair enough. Mike Woods did exactly what he had to do, and he completed a kind of a grand slam of stage wins for EF Pro Cycling, because they won at least a stage in every Grand Tour this season, which is smashing. And for a team like they are, you can't look down on a stage win just because you're protecting somebody at GC's position. So I think, yeah, Mike was kind of, for me, raised the perfect stage today.
I mean, he's entitled to say whatever he wants and do whatever he wants, really. I mean, he's in the break. He's had one dig, and then if they then. You know, choose to believe or not believe, or I mean, he's going to ride the way he wants to ride, isn't he? I always make the same point, really, in these situations. The only consequence is that people may remember that and not cooperate with you in future. And if that's the case, well, it's the price worth paying, because he won the stage. I mean, once you're out there, you've got to try to use, you know, within the rules, every little bit of advantage that you can. And that's trying to get away with doing less work, or, you know, manoeuvring others into a position that you want them to be in, or you're telling a bit of a fib. I mean, there's no rule.
It's also another benefit of having a rider up there. And, you know, Valverde was a pretty distant threat to Hugh Carthy, but you know, having him up there just gives him that opportunity to play that card and that's a benefit that comes from having a rider up there.
Use whatever advantage you can to outfox, especially as the size of the group comes down. I mean, if they believe that, then more fool them. I mean, he's just attacked you, and then he says, well, now I'm going to defend for my teammate. I mean, you wouldn't give that a minute's credence, would you? You'd just think, well, hang on, we're five of us racing for the stage. It's every man for themselves.
Yeah, there were no gifts made by anybody in that final group in the last 20Ks. I mean, they all attacked, as you said, in the Tale of the Tapas early on, Lionel. There was no gifts given by anybody. They all tried their luck. I mean, they were all looking at each other, and Mike Woods outwitted them, outfoxed them. So, no, not for me, perfect.
It's all a game, isn't it? And it's fascinating, really. And you never really know what's going on through people's minds. But, you know, when Frehley and Woods were briefly together, and it was Valverde, the two French riders let Valverde do all the closing. I mean, Valverde has, you know, could then justifiably turn around to them and say, well, look, what's, you know, come through. But they're not obliged to come through. It's once you get down to that part of the race, it really is just all is fair, really, as long as it's within the rules and you're not doing anything to actually endanger your opponents. I thought it was a smart win, really, because again, you would expect Woods to try and make the difference on the tougher bits of the climb, which he did. But then when he made his actual move, you know, he wasn't daunted by the fact that, you know, on paper, I would have put Omar Frehley as the kind of the strongest for that finish, with Valverde, obviously, with the experience and also perhaps the sprint finish, but then maybe a little bit of that dimmed with age. And the two Frenchmen being the smaller climbers, I thought were probably going to be up against it. But I didn't think it was a gimme for Woods by any stretch. I thought, you know, he was the sort of third most likely to win the stage when it came to that, down to that. But a really good couple of days for him in the race, because he was obviously second on Sunday to Formigal. And, well, you know, he had a bad start to the race, didn't he? Crashed on the first day and lost a lot of time. But that's, I gather from talking to Mitch Docker, that Woods was coming into this race looking for stage wins rather than trying to ride for an overall position. He was seventh in the Vuelta in 2017, wasn't he? But and you would think with everything going his way, he could replicate or maybe improve on that. But probably his better bet is to target individual stages. And he's come into the race in good form, hasn't he? He was looking good in the two Ardennes races, just coming up to, well, what was that? I mean, I'm so confused by the calendar now. What was that, a couple of weeks or so before the start of the Vuelta?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Hi, this is John Hassel from New Jersey in the US. I'm curious how much this year's disjointed, unpredictable schedule complicates nutrition plans for riders. I assume nutrition plans are coordinated with training to optimize performance in particular races at predictable times on the racing calendar. But if riders' schedules and even the races themselves are uncertain, how do you adjust and plan to be ready at the right time? Or do you just shift to a different approach focused on general nutrition with less focus on specific dates and challenges? Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for the question, John. I think this is a great question considering the year that we've just had. And you're absolutely right. In my experience, when I worked in cycling, normally we would plan out a nutritional plan almost around 6 months in advance. The riders would have their clear schedules. We'd be periodizing their nutrition, not only week by week, but month by month, in order that they would actually peak for their target race. Now, in all of those facets of nutrition, probably the one that made the biggest difference actually was getting down to race weight. And I think you've seen this year that this is a real big challenge for some of the riders, that some of them have probably pushed their weight too soon when the calendars got readjusted. And my suspicion is that the guys who were closer to race weight in terms of their natural body weight, in other words, they walk around closer to their natural race weight, to me, it looks like they're the guys that have ridden more consistently. So I think that's been the biggest challenge this year as an outsider looking in, is how do you get down to race weight at the correct trajectory without overcooking it, if you like.
Well, thanks very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. And over the coming episodes, we'll be hearing again from James Morton, who we heard from there. He's Director of Performance Solutions at Science and Sport. He's also Professor of Exercise, Metabolism and Nutrition at Liverpool John Moores University, formerly Team Sky nutritionist, and he works at Liverpool Football Club as well. A real fountain of knowledge. And a lot of you, a while ago when we asked for questions, sent in really great questions, and that was the first one we heard tonight. And I thought we'd play that one tonight because it's really interesting. A lot of talk about the new generation, how races this year seem to, well, the old generation seems to have been swept aside, and younger riders, as we saw at the Giro, are winning, and people positing various theories for that. Well, one there suggested by James, which I chatted about with him off the tape as well, just this issue of younger riders generally being far better able to control their weight and it becoming a much bigger problem for older riders. And I asked him how pronounced that was. He said very. And you know, it was something Geraint Thomas talked about before the tour, that one of the reasons why he wasn't performing before the tour was that he'd really struggled with his weight. And yeah, I thought that was interesting and definitely worth considering. I mean, why wouldn't it be a problem? Why wouldn't it be an issue or a factor other seasons too? Well, I think maybe the extended period of no racing just made that problem a little bit harder to deal with for, as he says, older riders in particular. So interesting.
Being an older guy, I can tell you it's very easy to lose weight. You drop the wine and you drop the cassoulet and you'll see the results come quickly.
I guess I always, I mean, you know, we know that when you get into your 40s, it gets hard to control the weight. But I guess that process maybe starts even earlier than we realised. And the margins are so small in professional sport that, you know, if it becomes even a small problem in your 30s, then it could become an insurmountable problem if you want to win a Grand Tour. Anyway, let's move back to the Giro, shall we? I mean, we'll be looking back on the Giro a little bit. I spoke to the Giro winner, Tale Gegenhart, today. I'm going to have a longer conversation with him later this week, talking through his Giro win, and we'll hear a bit from him. But we thought we'd ask our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio of Gazzetta dello Sport to give us his thoughts on the Giro. Here he is, Ciro.
Dear listeners, I would have liked to prepare my thoughts and read them in order to do a better speech, but at the end I have chosen for another choice. I mean, I'm now telling you whatever came in my mind without any speech prepared, because I think it's better. It has been always like this. And about the Giro, first of all, I can tell you the secret why Theo Gegenhardt has been able to win the Giro. I can explain you, and nobody knew this. I had the possibility to talk to Theo after Biancavallo stage, and then I told him, Theo, okay, you have won this stage, but you know, it's not enough to become more famous than me in UK, because Cycling Podcast gave me a huge popularity. So this is not enough. So if you want to be at least as famous as me in the United K, you have to win the Giro. One stage victory, two stage victories are not enough. And he did it in Milan. So only for you. This is the real secret of Theo. I mean, Italian public loves him for his character. He's something new, a Londoner. Okay, we know his origin Irish, maybe a little bit Scottish. Richard, you should know this better than me. But in any case, I mean, his style, although also his way of talking, I think that Italy loves Theo and this new generation of young riders. Certainly the spelling and pronunciation of his name is not easy, but you know, for the majority of Italian guys, it's also difficult to understand why in English, a language that I love, for example, the same two letters, O-O, for example, I know the example, moon and blood, do pronunciation completely different, for two equal letters. So Italians don't understand either this. Imagine the name, the pronunciation of town, but this doesn't matter. I mean, a beautiful victory for him. And for this Giro, I think certainly a deception for the fall of the shark, but in any case, I think that in this world situation, healthy, for I know I'm referring to the health problems, the great success for the Giro has been that the Giro was able to arrive to Milan. This is a pink jersey for the Giro, in my opinion, at the same level of the pink jersey of town. And really outstanding Giro for all the guys from Ineos, really a great team with an important Italian component. Don't forget Filippo Ganna, really outstanding is Giro with four victory. Dear listeners, these are my main thoughts, and I'm looking forward to see you again, to speak to you again, because you know, not me, not Theo, you are the only pink jersey.
Yeah, well, you can tell Ciro is still up there, you know, at the top of his game and at the top of the cycling world. He's probably the best Italian in the, he was probably the best Italian in Giro again this season.
A Frenchman's been wanting to make that gag for a long time. Yeah, they didn't have a great Giro, did they? But Ciro obviously had a great Giro, he was making plans with Theo Gegenhardt to do an event in London when we can do events again, which is something to look forward to. A piece of business from the Giro, we didn't put out the shout for Pedalers to Charm. There were a few nominations on social media, but we do have, or rather Stacey Snyder has made, a beautiful Giro Pedaler de Charm mug that we would like to give somebody. Richie Port was our Pedaler de Charm at the Tour de France. Please get in touch if you've got a nomination for a Pedaler de Charm. We want a good reason for the nomination. Going back to the roots of the Pedaler de Charm award, you know, what was charming, what caught your heart, I suppose, at the Giro? Let us know, and we'll maybe run a Twitter poll or two to find our Giro Pedaler de Charm and send them this beautiful mug. I think you had a suggestion, Francois.
Oh yeah, because Richie Porte won the Pedaler de Charm, overall Pedaler de Charm for the Tour de France, I wanted to keep, you know, with an Australian, and I might volunteer Ron Dennis as a Pedaler de Charm. I know it's slightly controversial, I'm sure, but in a way, you know, think it over. You if you do think it over, sleep over it, and you'll see it's not such a stupid
starts
suggestion.
To make sense.
Yeah. Well, after a few glasses of wine, you'll see it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Excellent. What did you both think of Mauro Vegni's reported comments about, he doesn't seem to have calmed down from either the rider protest that happened before stage 19, and also the fact that Jumbo Visma withdrew after Stephen Kruijswijk tested positive for COVID, and EF, of course, Jonathan Vaughters wrote his letter suggesting that the Giro end on the second rest day. He is threatening legal action against Jumbo Visma and EF, which I think is pretty tone deaf given the context. Especially Jumbo Visma, you know, who had in both cases actually, but Jumbo Visma pulled out the race when they had their leader test positive for COVID. I mean, as they said at the time, they were protecting themselves, but also the race from, you know, because we'd seen with Mitchelton Scott a case with Simon Yates, and then 3 or 4 days later there were 5 cases. So that was the kind of precedent we were looking at. So it's very, very, I think, ill-advised for Mauro Vegni to be making comments like that.
Mm. Well, I didn't have a chance to get into that debate because I was not with you guys the day of the protest. I agree. The position regarding the withdrawal of Jumbo-Visma and the letter written by the Jonathan Waters is probably a little bit excessive and not quite clever. But I agree 100% with him about the riders' strike. I know there's been lots of debate in the podcast from the friends of the podcast and everybody. But the way this protest took place, like they could have discussed that the night before and not in the morning. The fact that everybody knew the course, weeks and months in advance, and so everybody knew how long it was going to be. I mean, and the fact that the start town would paid money to the Giro organizers to have the start of the stage and to be forced to cancel all the celebrations and it seen from an organizer point of view is totally unacceptable. And in a way it made me think, why what would have we said if at the start of a Paris-Roubaix, because it's raining or hailing, rather suddenly say, oh, could we go straight to Carrefour de l'Arbre to make the race easier? It was, in my opinion, totally unacceptable. So I can understand why. I think luckily it didn't affect the outcome of the race and the outcome of the GC, but it might have. In this case, I thought Vigny is in his rights. But about Jumbo-Visma, retiring from the race, I think that there was a clever decision. And then so it's a bit of a twofold thing for me.
Without going back over what I said last week, and I do see your point, Francois. I think that the riders were not just complaining and protesting about the length of the stage because it was long or because the weather looked bad. It was a culmination of things over the course of that week, and also just the kind of the lack of flexibility in what is an extreme period for all of the riders and the teams after a particularly strange year. And the issue wasn't necessarily what the riders did and said or what Vigny did or said about that particular matter. The issue was that it was just dreadfully communicated, and there was just no one was speaking with one voice. And I've seen a few comments saying that, if the riders are going to not start a stage, then it has to be unanimous. Well, it's never going to be unanimous with 150 riders and then all of their teams and staff. But there does have to be some kind of bringing together of a unified voice, so that, with a one rider, one vote system on important issues, the riders can have a ballot, have a threshold where maybe, I don't know, perhaps two-thirds have to agree with a motion in order to make a statement or take some action. And surely the shambolic nature of what happened last Friday will, if anyone's got any sense, bring the riders and teams and race organisers a bit closer together. And as I said last week, recognise that they're actually all on the same side here. No one came out of that looking good. In the case of Vigny's threats for legal action, I mean, I'm just absolutely flabbergasted that they would want to sanction Jumbo-Visma, who did the absolute right thing for the security of the event. In the case of Jonathan Vaughter's letter, surely just a conversation between them would just smooth things out. I think, again, it was unfortunate that one team was seeming to speak on behalf of all the others without having canvassed the opinions of all the others first. And again, that's maybe a lesson for another day, and perhaps somebody will be able to bring together some sort of, without making it overly political or overly bureaucratic, but put in place some sort of you know, sets of policies to actually give the riders an opportunity to express their opinion in a clear and structured way, so we don't have an absolute mess of a day as we did on Friday. But Venny just needs to, I think, just retract. You know, legal threats is just a sort of toys out of the pram thing, and perhaps once the dust has properly settled, recognise that won't serve any benefit to anyone.
Well, let's return to Vuelta, shall we, where all the COVID tests on the rest day were negative, and the Vuelta has been praised for its the protocols that they have in place. They're not even signing on. They're doing face recognition. As we heard from one of our audio diarists, was it Nick Schultz? It was Nick Schultz. And, you know, we heard also from our Giro diarists a range of opinions about the strike in the most recent episode of Kilometer Zero, powered by Zwift. Cesare Benedetti of Bora Hansgrohe said he was ashamed to be a cyclist that morning. And, you know, we heard other riders who were in support of the protest. I'm sure we'll return to it, but let's return briefly to the Vuelta. And Lionel, you spoke to a Grand Tour debutant.
I did, yeah. Harry Tanfield, who was riding last season with Katusha. And of course, Katusha came to an end, and he's riding this year with AG2R. And he is riding his first Grand Tour for them. The team is already down to five riders, having lost a couple of guys on the first day and somebody else a couple of days later. So it's been a pretty challenging opening week for AG2R. But Harry Tanfield found himself in the break one day last week, and yesterday morning on the rest day, I caught up with him to find out how things had been going.
First day wasn't actually too bad. I mean, we had a lot of tailwind, so that was quite nice. And it wasn't too much stress. I think a lot of the first day as well was about positioning, and I made sure I was positioned at the front a lot, and I think I saved probably a lot of energy just by doing that. And the climbs were only 5 or 6%, so then going into the bottom climb, just positioned our sprinter, our climb at the best we could, and then about 25Ks to go. So the second day actually kicked off, the break had gone, and I think EF lit it up one of the first climbs after 20Ks, and that put me in the cars, and that was when I was really struggling actually, because the second day was probably the worst day. I'm not sure why, but then after day three, day four, the day I was in the breakaway, since then my legs have been good. It was kind of just like getting into the rhythm of it, I think, getting back into the race. I was thinking of having a dabble for the sprint actually at the end, with it being, you know, a bit fast and tailwind, and I knew it was going to be fast, so I put 55 on, and we came out of the D neutral, and it just started chucking it down in the last 5 minutes of neutral, so it was pretty sketchy. And I was just, you know, as soon as it rains, everyone just, you know, goes really slow, so I just went to the front and was behind the car when the D neutralised, and Willie, my old teammate, he went up the road with a confidence rider, and I just kind of, a gap was just open, and I was like, okay, well, I'll just go through this and ride on to them anyway. And I did, looked around, and another Burgos guy had come with me, and then the road just shut down. And it was like, oh, okay, we are going in the brick today then. But of all the days to do it, it was kind of a good day, and it wasn't, because everyone else was just cruising behind at like 200 watts. And then we were up the road, obviously having to ride quite hard to, when we could, actually pedal, even though we had a tailwind most of the day. Because the roads were just so big, the rolling speed of the peloton was so fast that for a lot of guys, they really just had a rest day. I mean, obviously, there was some points of stress when Movistar kicked it off and things like that, but for a lot of guys, it was a welcomed, steady day for them, and then, you know, just basically check out with 5K to go and roll in.
Well, that was Harry Tanfield. Another British rider is riding extremely well at the Vuelta, Hugh Carthy, and Daniel Freiba, our colleague who's working for ITV at the Vuelta, interviewed Hugh Carthy at the start this morning, and we thought we'd steal the first bit of that because, well, it's a classic of the genre.
Well, Hugh, I've been doing some research on you and, well, your birthplace on the rest day, Preston. The most interesting thing I found out about Preston is that it's the home of the world's biggest bus station, is that correct?
Europe's second largest, I believe, but don't quote me.
This is a very contentious issue, the size of this bus station. I can't quite understand why they haven't been able to establish where it is in the rankings.
I don't think anyone cares, that's why.
Daniel's had all day, all of the rest day to research Preston, and that's the best he could do. I mean, Preston is the home of Preston North End, the first ever English Football League champions. They were double winners in 1889, and they were the original Invincibles. Maybe that's why Daniel's not interested, because it takes the gloss off his pretend football team, Arsenal's Invincible season a few years ago.
I mean, well, how would that interview... Well, so how would you have interviewed Hugh Carthy then, Lionel? What would your...
I'm going to ask him about the bus station.
Oh, well, did I not get a funnier response? I think that was funnier. I think Daniel's the winner on this occasion. Well, sorry. You know, you just showing off your knowledge of Preston North End, that wouldn't have been great telly,
well,
would it?
Mate, I'm not really sure. Well, what was Daniel trying to do? Was that what it was, to elicit an amusing response about the biggest bus station or second biggest bus station in Western Europe?
I think it worked. It was successful. That's why we played it. Francois, I know, are watching and impressed by Guillaume Martin at the Vuelta, as I think we all are. He's been one of the men of the early part of the race, and he's very strong. And even though he's kind of out of it overall, he could have an impact on the race, I think.
Yeah, after that long display of Rule Britannia, I wanted to go back to the French corner and praise Guillaume Martin's season, actually, because he did his best Tour de France ever, and he's now in the polka dot jersey in the Vuelta, and he's really, really matured and improved. It's even more surprising to see him, you know, come of age now that he's joined Cofidis, and usually riders going to Cofidis tend to, you know, kind of falter a little bit. So it's even more of, you know, a praise of what he's doing. He's been you know, there almost every day during the Tour de France. He's been active, you know, almost every day as well in the Vuelta. He's getting there, you know. He's climbing. He's going there step by step, and it's a pity that he doesn't have the kick or the finish to actually win stages or win races. He really misses a little bit, you know, a little something to be a more successful rider. But you know, he's really getting closer to being a, you know, top five, top ten GC contender, and he's getting there, and it's great news.
And he's in the King of the Mountains jersey now, so he has that to target, yes. Perhaps.
That's right. Yeah. I think maybe. I mean, as you know, it's become a kind of a French specialty. Even in the Vuelta, we had Nicolas Hédé and David Moncoutier won the polka dot jersey on the Vuelta. So maybe it's one of the jerseys in the future Grand Tours he might be targeting, because obviously, you know, winning a Grand Tour seems out of reach. But yeah, let's see. I mean, we all love this guy. He's clever, you know. As you, like everybody knows, you know, Roglic is a ski jumper, so everybody knows Guillaume Martin is a philosopher. But he's a nice guy. He's interesting. He's a clever rider. He's doing the hard work. He's doing everything required to get there. So yeah, let's keep hoping he keeps improving.
Well, we should wrap things up for tonight from the Vuelta, and say the I guess reaction to the Giro will rumble on in our Grandest Tour podcast as we head towards Madrid now. Before we go tonight,
Bits of news that I picked up over the last few hours. ESPN Colombia have had a story with Egan Bernal in which the 2019 Tour de France champion has explained that he's been suffering from the spinal condition scoliosis and will be taking not weeks but months to rehabilitate from that. So that, we were talking a couple of nights ago, weren't we, about where does Theo Gegenhardt's Giro win put Ineos Grenadiers in terms of, you know, dividing up Grand Tours among their, you know, vast resources. Well, it could well be that Egan Bernal is not as fully in the picture next year as we would have expected. And just in the last 10 minutes, ASO have sent out a press release to announce that the Tour de France route for 2021, which was due to be unveiled at the Palais des Congrès in Paris, as it usually is on Thursday, will now be unveiled on television on Sunday evening, Sunday, November the 1st. So we'll find out the full route of the tour on Sunday. Francois, no doubt, already has the route in his back pocket, I expect. But we don't want no spoilers.
No, I can't tell you anything, of course. Well, obviously this is because of COVID, and I just wanted to have a last word about the Vuelta and no positive tests today. I think it's remarkable, as we're probably heading towards lockdown in France again, probably by the end of the week. How remarkable it is that the Tour de France, in some respect, the Giro and now the Vuelta have managed to be not COVID-free, but really kind of spared by the COVID crisis. And it seems to indicate that, you know, by taking the necessary measures, by, you know, wearing masks and keeping, you know, the social distancing, as we did, you know, covering the Tour on the spot, even though we went to the restaurant every night and we kept an almost normal life, it seems to indicate that just doing that is enough to curb the crisis so well. That's what we should all do, you know, wear the mask, keep the social distancing, be, you know, careful, and it should be all right.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Teo Gegenhardt, I saw, mentioned that he hadn't seen his family for 10 months, and a lot of riders, Mike Woods has talked about it too, have made big sacrifices, and I do get the impression that, you know, when it comes to discipline, cyclists are pretty good. Generally, professional cyclists need to be very, very disciplined to do what they do, and that's kind of stood them in good stead to make the sacrifices that they've needed to make to be able to race. And it is a credit to them, I think, and to the sport. Another bit of news rumbling on is the Richard Freeman hearing in Manchester, and more information, details coming out there, really in quite granular detail about, you know, various things that have gone on around about 2010 in particular. And we'll probably talk about that at greater length in an episode where we've maybe got a quieter stage, if we've got one. But there's a lot to digest, and we'll maybe do that maybe in the company of either Ian Boswell, who wrote for Team Sky, of course, or Lizzie Banks when they join us again. We've got stuff coming up on the Friends feed as well. If you sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, you'll get access to special episodes. We've got a couple of crackers coming up. And before we go, a quick thanks to some of you who have signed up as friends of the podcast. We're very grateful. Your support is very much appreciated. Fraser McGregor, Peter Darch, Mark Heed, James Mulholland, Adam Gibson, Matt Moran, Henry Peterkin, Nicholas Vincent, and Simon Runton.
And a big thank you to Guy Marks, Ronald Caraway, George Jones, Jeff Callum, Jose Valdiva, S. Boucher, Chris Rogers, Chris Johnston, and Mr. A.D. Oldman.
And a big thanks to Martin Murphy, Simon Everington, Duncan Brown, Chris Kelly, John Marsh, Stephen Afia, Will Griffith, Brandon Canty, and Mr. K. Chisholm.
Thank you very much, Francois.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.